attraction that seems to defy time. At the moment he desires this woman, he desires her with passion. He wants only her, and certainly the moment is an absolute, but a momentary absolute. Duped, the woman passes into the eternal. Deified by the embrace of the master, she believes she has always been divine and destined for the god, she alone. But male desire is as fleeting as it is imperious. Once satisfied, it dies rather quickly, while it is most often after love that the woman becomes his prisoner. This is the theme of a whole type of shallow literature and songs. A young man was passing by, a girl was singing, a young man was singing, a girl was crying. And even if the man is seriously attached to the woman, it still does not mean that she is necessary to him. Yet this is what she demands. Her abdication only saves her if it reinstates her empire. One cannot escape the play of reciprocity. So she must suffer or lie to herself. Most often she clutches first at the lie. She imagines the man's love as the exact counterpart of the love she bears him. With bad faith, she takes desire for love, an erection for desire, love for religion. She forces the man to lie to her. Do you love me? As much as yesterday? Will you always love me? She cleverly asks the questions just when there is not enough time to give nuanced and sincere answers, or when circumstances prevent them. Imperiously, she asks her questions during lovemaking, at the moment of convalescence, when sobbing, or on a railway station platform. She makes trophies of the answers she extorts, and in the absence of responses, she interprets the silences. Every genuine woman in love is more or less paranoid. I remember a woman friend who, when faced with the long silence from a far-off lover, declared, "When one wants to break up, one writes to announce it." Then, upon receiving an unambiguous letter, "When one really wants to break up, one doesn't write." It is often very difficult to decide where pathological delirium begins when hearing such confidences. Described by the panicking woman in love, the man's behavior always seems extravagant. He's neurotic, sadistic, repressed, a masochist, a devil, unstable, cowardly, or all of these together. He defies the most subtle psychological explanations. X adores me. He's wildly jealous. He wants me to wear a mask when I go out. But he's such a strange being and so suspicious of love that he keeps me in the hallway and doesn't invite me in when I ring his bell. Or, Z adored me, but he was too proud to ask me to go to Lyon, where he lives. I went there. I moved in with him. After 8 days, without an argument, he threw me out. I saw him twice afterward. The third time I called him and he hung up in the middle of the conversation. He's a neurotic. These mysterious stories become clearer when the man explains. I absolutely did not love her, or I liked her well enough, but I could not have lived 1 month with her. Bad faith in excess leads to the mental asylum. One of the constants of erotomania is that the lover's behavior seems enigmatic and paradoxical. From this slant, the patient's delirium always succeeds in breaking down the resistance of reality. A normal woman sometimes finally realizes the truth, recognizing that she is no longer loved. But as long as her back is not to the wall, she always cheats a little. Even in reciprocal love, there is a fundamental difference between the lover's feelings that she tries to hide. The man must, of course, be capable of justifying himself without her, since she hopes to be justified through him. If he is necessary to her, it is because she is fleeing her freedom. But if he assumes the freedom without which he would be neither a hero nor simply man, nothing and no one will be necessary for him. The dependence woman accepts comes from her weakness. How could she find a reciprocal dependence in the man she loves in his strength? A passionately demanding soul cannot find tranquility in love because she sets her sights on a contradictory aim. Torn and tormented, she risks being a burden to the one for whom she dreamed of being a slave. She becomes importunate and obnoxious for want of feeling indispensable. Here is a common tragedy. Wiser and less intransigent, the woman in love resigns herself. She is not all. She is not necessary. It is enough for her to be useful. Another can easily take her place. She is satisfied to be the one who is there. She recognizes her servitude without asking for reciprocity. She can thus enjoy modest happiness. But even in these limits, it will not be cloudless. Far more painfully than the wife, the woman in love waits. If the wife herself is exclusively a woman in love, the responsibilities of the home, motherhood, her occupations, and her pleasures will have little value in her eyes. It is the presence of her husband that lifts her out of the limbo of ennui. When you are not there, it seems not even worthwhile to greet the day. Everything that happens to me seems lifeless. I am no more than a little empty dress thrown on a chair, writes Cécile Sauvage early in her marriage. Note, the case is different if the wife has found her autonomy in the marriage. In such a case, love between the two spouses can be a free exchange of two self-sufficient beings. And we have seen that, very often, it is outside marriage that passionate love arises and blooms. One of the most remarkable examples of a life entirely devoted to love is Juliette Drouet's. It is an endless wait. I must always come back to the same starting point, meaning eternally waiting for you, she writes to Victor Hugo. I wait for you like a squirrel in a cage. My God, how sad it is for someone with my nature to wait from one end of life to another. What a day! I thought it would never end waiting for you. And now I feel it went too quickly since I did not see you. I find the day eternal. I wait for you because, after all, I would rather wait than believe you are not coming at all. It is true that Hugo, after having made her break off from her rich protector, Prince Demidov, confined Juliette to a small apartment and forbade her to go out alone for 12 years to prevent her from seeing her former friends. But even when her lot, she called herself your poor cloistered victim, had improved, she still continued to have no other reason to live than her lover, and not to see him very much. I love you, my dearest Victor, she wrote in 1841, but my heart is sad and full of bitterness. I see you so little, and the little I see you, you belong to me so little that all these littles make a whole of sadness that fills my heart and mind. She dreams of reconciling independence and love. I would like to be both independent and slave, independent through a state that nourishes me, and slave only to my love. But having totally failed in her career as an actress, she had to resign herself to being no more than a lover, from one end of life to the other. Despite her efforts to be of service to her idol, the hours were too empty. The 17,000 letters she wrote to Hugo at the rate of 300 to 400 every year are proof of this. Between visits from the master, she could only kill time. The worst horror of woman's condition in a harem is that her days are deserts of boredom. When the male is not using this object that she is for him, she is absolutely nothing. The situation of the woman in love is analogous. She only wants to be this loved woman, and nothing else has value in her eyes. For her to exist, then, her lover must be by her side, taken care of by her. She awaits his return, his desire, his waking, and as soon as he leaves her, she starts again to wait for him. Such is the curse that weighs on the heroines of Backstreet. Note, Fanny Hurst, Backstreet. And the Weather in the Streets. Note, Rosamund Lehman, The Weather in the Streets. Priestesses and victims of pure love. It is the harsh punishment inflicted on those who have not taken their destiny in their own hands. Waiting can be a joy. For the woman who watches for her loved one, knowing he is hurrying to her, that he loves her, the wait is a dazzling promise. But over and above the confident intoxication of love that changes absence itself into presence, the torment of worry gets confused with the emptiness of absence. The man might never return. I knew a woman who greeted her lover with surprise each time they met. I thought you would never return, she would say. And if he asked her why, because you could never return. When I wait, I always have the impression that I will never see you again. Above all, he may cease to love her. He may love another woman. The vehemence with which she tries to fool herself by saying, "He loves me madly, he can love no one but me," does not exclude the torture of jealousy. It is characteristic of bad faith that it allows passionate and contradictory affirmations. Thus, the madman who stubbornly takes himself for Napoleon does not mind admitting he is also a barber. The woman rarely consents to ask herself, "Does he really love me?" but asks herself 100 times, "Does he love another?" She does not accept that her lover's fervor could have dimmed little by little, nor that he gives less value to love than she does. She immediately invents rivals. She considers love both a free feeling and a magic spell, and she assumes that her male continues to love her in his freedom while being snared or tricked by some clever schemer. The man grasps the woman as being assimilated to him, in her imminence. Here is why he easily plays the bouboroche. He cannot imagine that she too could be someone who slips away from him. Jealousy for him is ordinarily just a passing crisis, like love itself. The crisis may be violent and even murderous, but rarely does it last long in him. Jealousy for him mainly appears derivative. When things go badly for him, or when he feels threatened by life, he feels derided by his wife. Note, this comes to the fore, for example, in Lagash's work, The Nature and Forms of Jealousy. The correct title of Lagash's book is La Jalousie Amoureuse, Jealousy in Love, translation. By contrast, a woman loving a man in his alterity and transcendence feels in danger at every moment. There is no great distance between betrayal by absence and infidelity. As soon as she feels unloved, she becomes jealous. Given her demands, it is always more or less true. Her reproaches and her grievances, whatever their pretexts, are converted into jealous scenes. This is how she will express her impatience, the ennui of waiting, the bitter feeling of her dependence, the regret of having only a mutilated existence. Her whole destiny is at stake in every glance her lover casts at another woman, since she has alienated her entire being in him. And she becomes irritated if, for one instant, her lover turns his eyes to another woman. If he reminds her that she has just been dwelling on a stranger for a long time, she firmly answers, "It's not the same thing." She is right. A man looked at by a woman receives nothing. Giving begins only at the moment when the feminine flesh becomes prey. But the coveted woman is immediately metamorphosed into a desirable and desired object, and the neglected woman in love returns to ordinary clay. Thus, she is always on the lookout. What is he doing? At whom is he looking? To whom is he talking? What one smile gave her, another smile can take back from her. An instant is enough to hurl her from the pearly light of immortality to everyday dusk. She has received everything from love. She can lose everything by losing it. Vague or definite, unfounded or justified, jealousy is frightening torture for the woman because it is a radical contestation of love. If the betrayal is certain, it is necessary to either renounce making a religion of love or renounce that love. It is such a radical upheaval that one can understand how the woman in love, both doubting and deceived, can be obsessed by the desire and fear of discovering the mortal truth. Being both arrogant and anxious, the woman is often constantly jealous, but wrongly so. Juliette Drouet had pangs of suspicion toward all the women who came near Hugo, only forgetting to fear Léonie Biard, who was his mistress for 8 years. When unsure, every woman is a rival and a danger. Love kills friendship insofar as the woman in love encloses herself in the universe of the loved man. Jealousy exasperates her solitude, thus constricting her dependence even more. But she finds there recourse against boredom. Keeping a husband is work. Keeping a lover is a kind of vocation. The woman who, lost in happy adoration, neglected her personal appearance, begins to worry about it again the moment she senses a threat. Dressing, caring for her home, or social appearances become moments of combat. Fighting is stimulating activity. As long as she is fairly certain to win, the woman warrior finds a poignant pleasure in it. But the tormented fear of defeat transforms the generously consented gift into a humiliating servitude. The man attacks in defense. Even a proud woman is forced to be gentle and passive. Maneuvers, prudence, trickery, smiles, charm, and docility are her best weapons. I still see this young woman whose bell I unexpectedly rang. I had just left her 2 hours before, badly made up, sloppily dressed, her eyes dull. But now she was waiting for him. When she saw me, she put on her ordinary face again. But for an instant, I had the time to see her, prepared for him, her face contracted in fear and hypocrisy, ready for any suffering behind her breezy smile. Her hair was carefully coiffed, special makeup brightened her cheeks and lips, and she was dressed up in a sparkling white lace blouse. Party clothes, fighting clothes. The masseuse, beauty consultant, and esthetician know how tragically serious their women clients are about treatments that seem useless. New seductions have to be invented for the lover. She has to become that woman he wishes to meet and possess. But all effort is in vain. She will not resurrect in herself that image of the other that first attracted him, that might attract him to another. There is the same duplicitous and impossible imperative in the lover as in the husband. He wants his mistress absolutely his and yet another. He wants her to be the answer to his dreams and still be different from anything his imagination could invent, a response to his expectations and an unexpected surprise. This contradiction tears the woman apart and dooms her to failure. She tries to model herself on her lover's desire. Many women who bloomed at the beginning of a love affair that reinforced their narcissism become frightening in their maniacal servility when they feel less loved. Obsessed and diminished, they irritate their lover. Giving herself blindly to him, the woman loses that dimension of freedom that made her fascinating at first. He was looking for his own reflection in her, but if he finds it too faithful, he becomes bored. One of the misfortunes of the woman in love is that her love itself disfigures her, demolishes her. She is no more than this slave, this servant, this too docile mirror, this too faithful echo. When she realizes it, her distress reduces her worth even more. She ends up losing all attraction with her tears, demands, and scenes. Inexistent is what he does. To be, she has to put her trust in a foreign consciousness and give up doing anything. "I only know how to love," writes Julie de l'Espinasse. "I who am only love." This title of a novel is the motto of the woman in love. Note, Dominique Rollin, Moi qui ne suis qu'amour. She is only love, and when love is deprived of its object, she is nothing. Often she understands her mistake, and so she tries to reaffirm her freedom, to find her alterity. She becomes flirtatious. Desired by other men, she interests her blasé lover again. Such is the hackneyed theme of many awful novels. Absence is sometimes enough to bring back her prestige. Albertine seems insipid when she is present and docile. From afar, she becomes mysterious again, and the jealous Proust appreciates her again. But these maneuvers are delicate. If the man sees through them, they only serve to reveal to him how ridiculous his slave's servitude is. And even their success can be dangerous. Because she is his, the lover disdains his mistress, but he is attached to her because she is his. Is it disdain, or is it attachment that an infidelity will kill? It may be that, vexed, the man turns away from the indifferent one. He wants her free, yes, but he wants her given. She knows this risk. It paralyzes her flirtatiousness. It is almost impossible for a woman in love to play this game skillfully. She is too afraid to be caught in her own trap, and insofar as she still reveres her lover, she is loath to dupe him. How can he remain a god in her eyes? If she wins the match, she destroys her idol. If she loses it, she loses herself. There is no salvation. A cautious woman in love, but these words clash, tries to convert the lover's passion into tenderness, friendship, habit, or she tries to attach him with solid ties, a child or marriage. This desire of marriage haunts many liaisons. It is one of security. The clever mistress takes advantage of the generosity of young love to take out insurance on the future. But when she gives herself over to these speculations, she no longer deserves the name of woman in love, for she madly dreams of securing the lover's freedom forever, but not of destroying it. And this is why, except in the rare case where free commitment lasts a whole life, love religion leads to catastrophe. With Mora, Mademoiselle de Lespinasse was lucky enough to tire of him first. She tired of him because she had met Guibert, who in return promptly tired of her. The love between Madame d'Agoult and Liszt died of this implacable dialectic. The passion, vitality, and ambition that made Liszt so easy to love destined him to other loves. The Portuguese nun could only be abandoned, the fire that made D'Annunzio so captivating. Note, according to Isadora Duncan, had a price, his infidelity. A rupture can deeply mark a man, but in the end, he has his life as man to live. The abandoned woman is nothing, has nothing. If she is asked, how did you live before? She cannot even remember. She let fall into ashes the world that was hers to adopt a new land from which she is brutally expelled. She gave up all the values she believed in, broke off her friendships. She finds herself without a roof over her head and the desert all around her. How could she begin a new life when outside her lover, there is nothing? She takes refuge in delirious imaginings as in former times in the convent. Or if she is too reasonable, there is nothing left but to die. Very quickly, like Mademoiselle de Lespinasse, or little by little. The agony can last a long time. When a woman has been devoted to a man, body and soul, for 10 or 20 years, when he has remained firmly on the pedestal where she put him, being abandoned is a crushing catastrophe. What can I do? Asks this 40-year-old woman. What can I do if Jacques no longer loves me? She dressed, fixed her hair, and made herself up meticulously. But her hardened face, already undone, could barely arouse a new love. And she herself, after 20 years spent in the shadow of a man, could she ever love another? There are many years still to live at 40. I still see that other woman who kept her beautiful eyes and noble features in spite of a face swollen with suffering, and who let her tears flow down her cheeks in public, blind and deaf, without even realizing it. Now the god is telling another the words invented for her. Dethroned queen, she no longer knows if she ever reigned over a true kingdom. If the woman is still young, she has the chance of healing. A new love will heal her. Sometimes she will give herself to it with somewhat more reserve, realizing that what is not unique cannot be absolute. But often she will be crushed even more violently than the first time, because she will have to redeem herself for her past defeat. The failure of absolute love is a productive ordeal only if the woman is capable of taking herself in hand again. Separated from Abelard, Heloise was not a wreck because, directing an abbey, she constructed an autonomous existence. Colette's heroines have too much pride and too many resources to let themselves be broken by an amorous disillusion. Renée Néret is saved by her work, and Sidot tells her daughter that she was not too worried about her emotional destiny because she knew that Colette was much more than a woman in love. But there are few crimes that bring worse punishment than this generous mistake, to put oneself entirely in another's hands. Authentic love must be founded on reciprocal recognition of two freedoms. Each lover would then experience himself as himself and as the other. Neither would abdicate his transcendence. They would not mutilate themselves. Together, they would both reveal values and ends in the world. For each of them, love would be the revelation of self through the gift of self and the enrichment of the universe. In his work, La Connaissance de Soi, The Discovery of Self, note, the correct title of the work is La Découverte de Soi, translation. Georges Gustave summarizes precisely what man demands of love. Love reveals us to ourselves by making us come out of ourselves. We affirm ourselves by contact with that which is foreign and complementary to us. Love as a form of understanding discovers new heavens and new earths even in the very landscape where we have always lived. Here is the great secret. The world is other. I myself am other. And I am no longer alone in knowing it. Even better, someone taught me this. Woman, therefore, plays an indispensable and capital role in the consciousness man has of himself. This accounts for the importance the young man gives to love's apprenticeship. Note, refer to Volume 1. We have seen how Stendhal and Malraux marvel at the miracle that I myself am another. But Gustorf is wrong to write, and in the same way, man represents for the woman an indispensable intermediary of herself to herself. Because today, her situation is not the same. Man is revealed in the guise of another, but he remains himself, and his new face is integrated into the whole of his personality. It would only be the same for woman if she also existed essentially for herself. This would imply that she possessed an economic independence, that she projected herself toward her own ends and surpassed herself without intermediary toward the group. Thus, equal loves are possible, such as the one Malraux describes between Kyo and Mei. It can even happen that the woman plays the virile and dominating role, like Madame de Warrens with Rousseau, Leia with Chéri. But in most cases, the woman knows herself only as other. Her for others merges with her very being. Love is not for her an intermediary between self and self because she does not find herself in her subjective existence. She remains engulfed in this loving woman that man has not only revealed but also created. Her salvation depends on this despotic freedom that formed her and can destroy her in an instant. She spends her life trembling in fear of the one who holds her destiny in his hands without completely realizing it and without completely wanting it. She is in danger in an other, an anguished and powerless witness of her own destiny. Tyrant and executioner in spite of himself, this other wears the face of the enemy in spite of her and himself. Instead of the sought-after union, the woman in love experiences the bitterest of solitudes. Instead of complicity, struggle, and often hate. Love for the woman is a supreme attempt to overcome the dependence to which she is condemned by assuming it. But even consented to, dependence can only be lived in fear and servility. Men have rivaled each other, proclaiming that love is a woman's supreme accomplishment. A woman who loves like a woman becomes a more perfect woman, says Nietzsche, and Balzac. In the higher order, man's life is glory, woman's is love. Woman is equal to man only in making her life a perpetual offering, as his is perpetual action. But there again is a cruel mystification, since what she offers, he cares not at all to accept. Man does not need the unconditional devotion he demands, nor the idolatrous love that flatters his vanity. He only accepts them on the condition that he does not satisfy the demands these attitudes reciprocally imply. He preaches to the woman about giving, and her gifts exasperate him. She finds herself disconcerted by her useless gifts, disconcerted by her vain existence. The day when it will be possible for the woman to love in her strength and not in her weakness, not to escape from herself, but to find herself, not out of resignation, but to affirm herself, love will become for her, as for man, the source of life and not a mortal danger. For the time being, love epitomizes in its most moving form the curse that weighs on woman trapped in the feminine universe. The mutilated woman, incapable of being self-sufficient. Innumerable martyrs to love attest to the injustice of a destiny that offers them as ultimate salvation, a sterile hell. Chapter 13. The Mystic. Love has been assigned to woman as her supreme vocation, and when she addresses it to a man, she is seeking God in him. If circumstances deny her human love, if she is disappointed or demanding, she will choose to worship the divinity in God himself. It is true that there are also men who have burned with this flame, but they are rare, and their fervor has been of a highly refined intellectual form. Women, though, who abandon themselves to the delights of celestial marriages are legion, and they experience them in a strangely effective way. Women are accustomed to living on their knees. Normally, they expect their salvation to descend from heaven, where males reign. Men, too, are enveloped in clouds. Their majesty is revealed from beyond the veils of their bodily presence. The beloved is always more or less absent. He communicates with her, his worshiper, in ambiguous signs. She only knows his heart by an act of faith, and the more superior to her he seems, the more impenetrable his behavior seems to her. We have seen that in erotomania, this faith resisted all refutations. A woman does not need to see or touch to feel the presence at her side. Whether it be a doctor, a priest, or God, she will find the same incontestable proof. She will welcome as a slave the waves of a love that falls from on high into her heart. Human love and divine love melt into one not because the latter is a sublimation of the former, but because the former is also a movement toward a transcendent, toward the absolute. In any case, the woman in love has to save her contingent existence by uniting with the whole incarnated in a sovereign person. This ambiguity is flagrant in many cases, pathological or normal, where the lover is deified, where God has human traits. I will only cite this one reported by Ferdiere in his work on erotomania. It is the patient who is speaking. In 1923, I corresponded with a journalist from La Presse. Every day I read his articles about morality. I read between the lines. It seemed to me that he was answering me, giving me advice. I wrote him love letters. I wrote to him a lot. In 1924, it suddenly came to me. It seemed to me that God was looking for a woman, that he was going to come and speak to me. I had the impression he had given me a mission, chosen me to found a temple. I believed myself to be the center of a big complex where doctors would take care of women. It was then that I was transferred to the Clermont Mental Institution. There were young doctors who wanted to change the world. In my cabin, I felt their kisses on my fingers. I felt their sex organs in my hands. Once they told me, "You are not sensitive, but sensual. Turn over." I turned over and I felt them in me. It was very pleasant. The head doctor, Dr. D, was like a god. I really felt there was something when he came near my bed. He looked at me as if to say, "I am all yours." He really loved me. One day he looked at me insistently in a truly extraordinary way. His green eyes became blue as the sky. They widened intensely in an incredible way. He saw the effect that produced all the while speaking to another woman patient, and he smiled. And I thus remained fixated, fixated on Dr. D. One nail does not replace another, and in spite of all my lovers, I have had 15 or 16. I could not separate myself from him. That's why he's guilty. For more than 12 years, I have been having mental conversations with him. When I wanted to forget him, he reappeared. He was sometimes a bit mocking. "You see, I frighten you," he said again. "You can love others, but you will always come back to me." I often wrote him letters, even making appointments I would keep. Last year I went to see him. He was remote. There was no warmth. I felt so silly, and I left. People tell me he married another woman, but he will always love me. He is my husband. And yet the act has never taken place, the act that would make the fusion. "Abandon everything," he sometimes says. "With me you will always rise upward. You will not be like a being of the earth." You see, each time I look for God, I find a man. Now I don't know what religion I should turn to. Note: Erotomania, Translation. This is a pathological case, but there is this inextricable confusion in many devotees between man and God. In particular, the confessor occupies an ambiguous place between heaven and earth. He listens with carnal ears to the penitent who bears her soul, but it is a supernatural light that shines in the gaze with which he enfolds her. He is a divine man. He is God in the appearance of a man. Madame Guyon describes her meeting with Father Lacombe in these terms. It seems to me that an effect of grace came from him to me by the most intimate soul and returned from me to him so that he felt the same thing. The priest's intercession pulled her out of the drought she had been suffering from for years and inflamed her soul once again with ardor. She lived by his side during her entire great mystical period, and she admits, "There was nothing but one whole unity, so that I could no longer tell him apart from God." It would be too simple to say she was really in love with the man, and she feigned to love God. She also loved this man because he was something other than himself in her eyes. Like Ferdiere's patient, she was groping for the supreme source of values. That is what every mystic is aiming for. The male intermediary is sometimes useful for her to launch herself toward heaven's desert, but he is not indispensable. Having difficulty separating reality from play, the act from magical behavior, the object from imagination, woman is singularly likely to presentify through her body an absence. What is much less humorous is confusing mysticism with erotomania, as has sometimes been done. The erotomaniac feels glorified by the love of a sovereign being. He is the one who takes the initiative in the love relationship. He loves more passionately than he is loved. He makes his feelings known by clear but secret signs. He is jealous and irritated by the chosen woman's lack of fervor. He does not hesitate, then, to punish her. He almost never manifests himself in a carnal and concrete form. All these characteristics are found in mystics. In particular, God cherishes for all eternity the soul he inflames with his love. He shed his blood for her. He prepares splendid apotheoses for her. The only thing she can do is abandon herself to his flames without resistance. It is accepted today that erotomania takes a sometimes platonic and sometimes sexual form. Likewise, the body has a greater or lesser role in the feelings the mystic devotes to God. Her effusions are modeled on those that earthly lovers experience. While Angela of Foligno contemplates an image of Christ holding Saint Francis in his arms, he tells her, "This is how I will hold you tight, and much more than can be seen by the body's eyes. I will never leave you if you love me." Madame Guyon writes, "Love gave me no respite. I said to him, 'Oh, my love, enough, leave me. I want the love that thrills my soul with ineffable tremors, the love that makes me swoon. Oh, my God, if you made the most sensual of women feel what I feel, they would soon quit their false pleasures to partake of such true riches." Saint Teresa's vision is well known. "In an angel's hands I saw a great golden spear. This he plunged into my heart several times so that it penetrated my entrails. When he pulled it out, I felt that he took them with it and left me utterly consumed by the great love of God. The pain was so severe that it made me utter several moans. What I am certain of is that the pain penetrates the depths of my entrails, and it seems to me that they are torn when my spiritual spouse withdraws the arrow he uses to enter them." It is sometimes piously claimed that the poverty of language makes it necessary for the mystic to borrow this erotic vocabulary, but she also has only one body, and she borrows from earthly love not only words, but also physical attitudes. She has the same behavior when offering herself to God as offering herself to a man. This, however, does not at all diminish the validity of her feelings. When Angela of Foligno becomes pale and dry, or then full and flushed, according to the rhythm of her heart, when she breaks down in deluges of tears. Note, tears burned her cheeks to such an extent that she had to apply cold water, says one of her biographers. When she comes back to Earth, it is hardly possible to consider these phenomena as purely spiritual, but to explain them by her excessive emotivity alone is to invoke the poppy's sleep-inducing virtue. The body is never the cause of subjective experiences, since it is the subject himself in his objective form. The subject experiences his attitudes in the unity of his existence. Both adversaries and admirers of mystics think that giving a sexual content to St. Therese's ecstasies is to reduce her to the rank of a hysteric. But what diminishes the hysterical subject is not the fact that his body actively expresses his obsessions. It is that he is obsessed, that his freedom is subjugated and annulled. The mastery a fakir acquires over his body does not make him its slave. Bodily gestures can be part of the expression of a freedom. St. Therese's texts are not at all ambiguous, and they justify Bernini's statue showing us the swooning saint in thrall to a stunning sensuality. It would be no less false to interpret her emotions as simple sexual sublimation. There is not first an unavowed sexual desire that takes the form of divine love. The woman in love herself is not first the prey of a desire without object that then fixes itself on an individual. It is the presence of the lover that arouses an excitement in her immediately intended to him. Thus, in one movement, St. Therese seeks to unite with God and experiences this union in her body. She is not slave to her nerves and hormones. Rather, she should be admired for the intensity of a faith that penetrates to the most intimate regions of her flesh. In truth, as St. Therese herself understood, the value of a mystical experience is measured not by how it has been subjectively experienced, but by its objective scope. The phenomena of ecstasy are approximately the same for St. Therese and Marie Alacoque. The interest of their message is very different. St. Therese situates the dramatic problem of the relationship between the individual and the transcendent being in a highly intellectual way. She lived an experience as a woman whose meaning extends beyond any sexual specification. It has to be classified along with that of St. John of the Cross, but it is a striking exception. What her minor sisters provide is an essentially feminine vision of the world and of salvation. It is not transcendence they are aiming for. It is the redemption of their femininity. Note, for Catherine of Siena, theological preoccupations nevertheless remain very important. She also is of a rather virile type. The woman first seeks in divine love what the woman asks for in man's love, the apotheosis of her narcissism. This sovereign gaze fixed on her attentively and lovingly is a miraculous chance for her. Throughout her life as a girl and young woman, Madame Guyon had always been tormented by the desire to be loved and admired. A modern Protestant mystic, Mademoiselle Vey, writes, "Nothing makes me unhappier than having no one interested in me in a special and sympathetic way, in what is taking place in me." Madame Krudner imagined that God was constantly occupied with her, to such an extent that, says Sainte-Beuve, in the most decisive moments with her lover, she moaned, "My God, how happy I am! I ask you to forgive my extreme happiness." One can understand the intoxication that permeates the heart of the narcissist when all of heaven becomes her mirror. Her deified image is infinite, like God himself. It will never disappear. And at the same time, she feels in her burning, palpitating, and love-drowned breast, her soul created, redeemed, and cherished by the adoring Father. It is her double. It is she herself she is embracing, infinitely magnified by God's mediation. These texts of St. Angela of Foligno are particularly significant. This is how Jesus speaks to her. "My daughter, sweeter to me than I am to you, my temple, my delight, my daughter, my beloved, love me because you are very much loved by me, much more than you could love me. Your whole life, your eating, drinking, your sleeping, and all that you do are pleasing to me. I will do great things in you in the sight of the nations. Through you I shall be known, and my name will be praised by many nations. My daughter and my sweet spouse, I love you so much more than any other women. And again, my daughter, sweeter to me than I am to you, my delight, the heart of God Almighty is now upon your heart. God Almighty has deposited much love in you, more than in any woman of this city. He takes delight in you. And once more, such is the love I have for you that I am totally unable to remember your faults, and my eyes no longer see them. In you, I have deposited a great treasure. The chosen woman cannot fail to respond passionately to such ardent declarations, falling from such a lofty place. She tries to connect with the lover using the usual technique of the woman in love, annihilation. I have only one concern, which is to love, to forget myself, and to annihilate myself, writes Marie Alacoque. Ecstasy bodily mimics this abolition of self. The subject no longer sees or feels. He forgets his body, disavows it. The blinding and sovereign presence is indirectly indicated by the intensity of this abandon, by the hopeless acceptance of passivity. Madame Guyon's quietism erected this passivity into a system. As for her, she spent a great deal of her time in a kind of catalepsy. She slept, wide awake. Most women mystics are not satisfied with abandoning themselves passively to God. They actively apply themselves to self-annihilation by the destruction of their flesh. Of course, asceticism was also practiced by monks and brothers, but woman's relentlessness in violating her flesh has specific characteristics. We have seen how ambiguous the woman's attitude to her body is. It is through humiliation and suffering that she metamorphoses it into glory. Given over to a lover as a thing of pleasure, she becomes a temple, an idol. Torn by the pain of childbirth, she creates heroes. The mystic will torture her flesh to have the right to claim it. Reducing it to abjection, she exalts it as the instrument of her salvation. This accounts for the strange excesses of some women saints. Saint Angela of Foligno recounts her delectation in drinking the water in which she had just washed the leper's hands and feet. This concoction filled us with such sweetness that joy followed us and brought it home with us. Never had I drunk with such delight. A piece of scaly skin from one of the leper's wounds had stuck in my throat. Rather than spitting it out, I tried very hard to swallow it, and I succeeded. It seemed to me that I had just received communion. Never will I be able to express the delights that flooded over me. It is known that Marie Alacoque cleaned a sick person's vomit with her tongue. She describes in her autobiography her happiness when she had filled her mouth with the excrement of a man with diarrhea. Jesus rewarded her by keeping her lips glued to his sacred heart for 3 hours. Devotion has a carnal coloration in countries of ardent sensuality like Italy and Spain. In a village in Abruzzo, even today, women tear their tongues by licking the rocks on the ground along the stations of the cross. In all these practices, they are only imitating the Redeemer, who saved flesh by the abasement of his own flesh. Women show their sensitivity to this great mystery in a much more concrete way than males. God appears to woman more readily in the figure of the husband. Sometimes he reveals himself in his glory, dazzlingly white and beautiful, and dominating. He clothes her in a wedding dress, he crowns her, takes her by the hand, and promises her a celestial apotheosis. But most often, he is a being of flesh, the wedding ring Jesus had given to Saint Catherine and that she wore, invisible, on her finger, was this ring of flesh that circumcision had cut off. Above all, he is a mistreated and bloody body. It is in the contemplation of the crucified that she drowns herself the most fervently. She identifies with the Virgin Mary holding the corpse of her son in her arms, or with Magdalene standing at the foot of the cross and being sprinkled with the beloved's blood. Thus does she satisfy her sadomasochistic fantasies. In the humiliation of God, she admires man's fall. Inert, passive, covered with sores, the crucified is the inverted image of the white and red martyr offered to wild beasts, to the knife, to males, and with whom the little girl has so often identified. She is thrown into confusion seeing that man-god, has assumed his role. It is she who is placed on the wood, promised the splendor of the resurrection. It is she proves it. Her forehead bleeds under the crown of thorns. Her hands, her feet, her side are transpierced by an invisible iron. Out of the 321 people with stigmata recognized by the Catholic Church, only 47 are men. The others, including Helen of Hungary, Joan of the Cross, G. von Osten, Ozana of Mantua, and Claire of Montefalco, are women who are, on average, past the age of menopause. Catherine Emmerich, the most famous, was marked prematurely. At the age of 24, having desired the sufferings of the crown of thorns, she saw coming toward her a dazzling young man who pushed this crown onto her head. The next day, her temples and forehead swelled, and blood began to flow. 4 years later, in ecstasy, she saw Christ with rays pointed like fine blades coming from his wounds, and drops of blood then sprang from the saint's hands, feet, and side. She sweated blood. She spat blood. Still today, every Good Friday, Teresa Neumann turns a face dripping with Christ's blood toward her visitors. The mysterious alchemy that changes flesh into glory ends in the stigmata, since, in the form of a bloody pain, they are the presence of divine love itself. It is quite understandable why women particularly are attached to the metamorphosis of the red flow into pure golden flame. They have a horror of this blood that runs out of the side of the King of Men. Saint Catherine of Siena speaks of it in almost all her letters. Angela of Foligno lost herself in the contemplation of the heart of Jesus and the gaping wound in his side. Catherine Emmerich put on a red shirt so as to resemble Jesus when he was like a cloth soaked in blood. She saw all things through Jesus's blood. We have seen in which circumstances Marie Alacoque quenched her thirst for 3 hours from the sacred heart of Jesus. It was she who offered the enormous red clot surrounded by flamboyant darts of love to the adoration of the faithful. That is the emblem symbolizing the great feminine dream, from blood to glory through love. Ecstasies, visions, and dialogues with God, this interior experience is sufficient for some women. Others feel the need to communicate it to the world through acts. The connection between action and contemplation takes two very different forms. There are women of action, like Saint Catherine, Saint Teresa, and Joan of Arc, who are well aware of the goals they set themselves and who lucidly invent the means to reach them. Their revelations merely give an objective form to their certainties. They encourage them to take the paths they have carefully planned. There are women narcissists like Madame Guyon and Madame Krudner who, at the limit of silent fervor, feel suddenly in an apostolic state. Note, Madame Guyon. They are not very precise concerning their tasks, and, like patronesses seeking excitement, they do not care too much what they do as long as it is something. Thus, after displaying herself as ambassador and novelist, Madame Krudener interiorized the conception she had of her own worth. It was not to see definite ideas triumph, but to see herself confirmed in her role as God's inspired one, that she took the destiny of Alexander I in hand. If a little beauty and intelligence are often enough for a woman to feel endowed with a holy character, it is even more so when she knows she is God's chosen. She feels filled with a mission. She preaches dubious doctrines. She eagerly founds sects, and this allows her to effectuate, through the members of the group she inspires, a thrilling multiplication of her personality. Mystical fervor, like love and even narcissism, can be integrated into active and independent lives. But in themselves, these attempts at individual salvation can only result in failures. Either the woman establishes a relation with an unreal, her double or God, or she creates an unreal relation with a real being. In any case, she has no grasp on the world. She does not escape her subjectivity. Her freedom remains mystified. There is only one way of accomplishing it authentically. It is to project it by a positive action into human society. Part 4. Toward Liberation. Chapter 14. The Independent Woman. French law no longer includes obedience among a wife's duties, and every woman citizen has become a voter. These civic liberties remain abstract if there is no corresponding economic autonomy. The kept woman, wife or mistress, is not freed from the male just because she has a ballot paper in her hands. While today's customs impose fewer constraints on her than in the past, such negative licenses have not fundamentally changed her situation. She remains a vassal, imprisoned in her condition. It is through work that woman has been able, to a large extent, to close the gap separating her from the male. Work alone can guarantee her concrete freedom. The system based on her dependence collapses as soon as she ceases to be a parasite. There is no longer need for a masculine mediator between her and the universe. The curse on the woman vassal is that she is not allowed to do anything, so she stubbornly pursues the impossible quest for being through narcissism, love, or religion. When she is productive and active, she regains her transcendence. She affirms herself concretely as subject in her projects. She senses her responsibility relative to the goals she pursues and to the money and rights she appropriates. Many women are conscious of these advantages, even those with the lowest level jobs. I heard a cleaning woman, as she was washing a hotel lobby floor, say, "I never asked anyone for anything. I made it on my own." She was as proud of being self-sufficient as a Rockefeller. However, one must not think that the simple juxtaposition of the right to vote and a job amounts to total liberation. Work today is not freedom. Only in a socialist world would the woman who has one be sure of the other. Today, the majority of workers are exploited. Moreover, social structures have not been deeply modified by the changes in women's condition. This world has always belonged to men and still retains the form they have imprinted on it. It is important not to lose sight of these facts that make the question of women's work complex. An important and self-righteous woman recently carried out a study on women workers at a Renault factory. She asserts that they would rather stay at home than work in a factory. Without a doubt, they are economically independent only within an economically oppressed class. And besides, tasks carried out in a factory do not free them from household chores. Note, I said in Volume 1, Part 2, History, how burdensome these are for the woman who works outside the home. If they had been able to choose between 40 hours of weekly work in a factory or at home, they would undoubtedly have responded quite differently, and they might even accept both jobs eagerly if, as women workers, they would become part of a world that would be their world, that they would proudly and happily participate in building. In today's work, without even mentioning women who work on the land, note whose condition we examined, most working women do not escape the traditional feminine world. Neither society nor their husbands give them the help needed to become, in concrete terms, the equals of men. Only those women with political convictions, active in trade unions, who are confident in the future, can give an ethical meaning to the thankless daily labor. But as women deprived of leisure time and inheriting a tradition of submissiveness, it is understandable that they are just beginning to develop their political and social awareness. It is understandable that since they do not receive the moral and social benefits they could legitimately expect in exchange for their work, they simply resign themselves to its constraints. It is also understandable that a shop girl, an office worker, or a secretary should not want to give up the advantages of having a male to lean on. I have already said that it is an almost irresistible temptation for a young woman to be part of a privileged caste when she can do so simply by surrendering her body. She is doomed to have love affairs because her wages are minimal for the very high standard of living society demands of her. If she settles for what she earns, she will be no more than a pariah. Without decent living accommodations or clothes, all amusement and even love will be refused her. Virtuous people preach asceticism to her. In fact, her diet is often as austere as a Carmelite's, but not everyone can have God as a lover. She needs to please men to succeed in her life as a woman. So she will accept help. Her employer cynically counts on this when he pays her a pittance. Sometimes this help will enable her to improve her situation and achieve real independence. But sometimes she will give up her job to become a kept woman. She often does both. She frees herself from her lover through work, and she escapes work thanks to her lover. But then she experiences the double servitude of a job and masculine protection. For the married woman, her salary usually only means extra income. For the woman who is helped, it is the man's protection that seems inessential. But neither woman buys total independence through her own efforts. However, there are quite a lot of privileged women today who have gained economic and social autonomy in their professions. They are the ones who are at issue when the question of women's possibilities and their future is raised. While they are still only a minority, it is particularly interesting to study their situation closely. They are the subject of continuing debate between feminists and anti-feminists. The latter maintain that today's emancipated women do not accomplish anything important, and that besides, they have trouble finding their inner balance. The former exaggerate the emancipated women's achievements and are blind to their frustrations. In fact, there is no reason to assume that they are on the wrong track. And yet it is obvious that they are not comfortably settled in their new condition. They have come only halfway as yet. Even the woman who has emancipated herself economically from man is still not in a moral, social, or psychological situation identical to his. Her commitment to and focus on her profession depend on the context of her life as a whole. And when she starts her adult life, she does not have the same past as a boy. Society does not see her with the same eyes. She has a different perspective on the universe. Being a woman poses unique problems to an autonomous human being today. The advantage man enjoys and which manifests itself from childhood onward is that his vocation as a human being in no way contradicts his destiny as a male. The fact that the phallus is assimilated with transcendence means that man's social and spiritual successes endow him with virile prestige. He is not divided. However, for a woman to accomplish her femininity, she is required to be object and prey. That is, she must renounce her claims as a sovereign subject. This is the conflict that singularly characterizes the situation of the emancipated woman. She refuses to confine herself to her role as female because she does not want to mutilate herself. But it would also be a mutilation to repudiate her sex. Man is a sexed human being. Woman is a complete individual and equal to the male, only if she too is a sexed human being. Renouncing her femininity means renouncing part of her humanity. Misogynists have often reproached intellectual women for letting themselves go, but they also preach to them. If you want to be our equals, stop wearing makeup and polishing your nails. This advice is absurd, precisely because the idea of femininity is artificially defined by customs and fashion. It is imposed on every woman from the outside. It may evolve so that its fashion standards come closer to those of men. On the beach, women now wear trousers. That does not change the core of the problem. The individual is not free to shape the idea of femininity at will. By not conforming, a woman devalues herself sexually and consequently socially because society has incorporated sexual values. Rejecting feminine attributes does not mean acquiring virile ones. Even a transvestite cannot turn herself into a man. She is a transvestite. We have seen that homosexuality also constitutes a specification. Neutrality is impossible. There is no negative attitude that does not imply a positive counterpart. The adolescent girl often thinks she can simply scorn convention, but by doing so, she is making a statement. She is creating a new situation involving consequences she will have to assume. Whenever one ignores an established convention, one becomes a rebel. A flamboyantly dressed woman is lying when she ingenuously claims she is simply dressing to suit herself, and that is all. She knows perfectly well that suiting herself is an absurdity. Inversely, if she does not want to look eccentric, she follows the rules. Choosing defiance is a risky tactic, unless it is a positively effective action. More time and energy are spent than saved. A woman who has no desire to shock, no intention to devalue herself socially, has to live her woman's condition as a woman. Very often, her professional success even requires it. But while conformity is quite natural for a man, custom being based on his needs as an autonomous and active individual, the woman who is herself also subject and activity has to fit into a world that has doomed her to passivity. This servitude is even greater since women confined to the feminine sphere have magnified its importance. They have made dressing and housekeeping difficult arts. The man barely has to care about his clothes. They are comfortable, adapted to his active life, and need not be original. They are hardly part of his personality. What's more, no one expects him to take care of them himself. Some woman, volunteer or paid, delivers him from this chore. The woman, on the other hand, knows that when people look at her, they do not distinguish her from her appearance. She is judged, respected, or desired in relation to how she looks. Her clothes were originally meant to doom her to impotence, and they still remain fragile. Stockings run, heels wear down. Light-colored blouses and dresses get dirty. Pleats unpleat. But she must still repair most of these accidents herself. Her peers will never volunteer to help her out.